Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
50 years ago, in 1972, President Richard Nixon made his historic visit to China, opening the door to diplomatic and trade relations between that country and the U.S. It took until 1994 for China to open up to Hollywood movies, a consequential move for China, the American movie industry, and cultural values worldwide. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. I'm your host, Renee Garfinkel, and I'm pleased to welcome Eric Schwartzel to the show today. He's the film industry reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and he's joining us to talk about his new book, Red Carpet: Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy. Eric Schwartzel, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me, Dr. Garfinkel.
Please call me Renee.
Okay, thank you, Renee.
Eric, just from reading your book, you have deep knowledge of movies and film history, and I'm guessing that you're a movie lover. So before we get to your book, what are your favorite movies of all time?
Oh, that's a great question. It's actually one that I haven't been asked in promoting this book. I think that I've thought about this before, and I think if I had to pick one title, I might pick the Alfred Hitchcock film Strangers on a Train, which I absolutely adore. I have to say, I love the movie Moulin Rouge, and the movie Capote, I think, is probably my favorite movie about writing and writers. And then the best movie, I had to watch a lot of movies while reporting this book, and the best movie I watched for the reporting was Farewell, My Concubine, the Chinese movie from the late 1980s. But those are some titles that come to mind. I mean, it's interesting, though. I always say, you know, when I started covering the film industry, I have to watch a lot of great movies, but I also have to watch a lot of terrible movies. And you know, it's like covering anything, right? Like sometimes whenever you have to cover it and look at it from a business perspective, you have to sort of divorce yourself from whether or not you're actually enjoying it.
Okay, so we shouldn't all envy you for having to watch movies as part of your job.
Yeah. Careful what you wish for, I would say.
Right. Well, movies have always been vehicles for propaganda, or at least presenting ideology. So your premise is that today's movie environment is different in some qualitative and quantitative way from the way it was before. But how is it different from, let's say, the 1930s and 40s when America dominated the field?
This is a key distinction, I think, because whenever I was reporting this book and I would talk to people about China's influence on Hollywood, I always noticed how queasy it made some Americans to have a foreign government influencing what we consider probably the most effective soft power tool in our country's history. And I think it has, that queasiness has its roots in the 30s and 40s, because that is when we really started to see Hollywood become conscripted by its government. And even in its earliest days, I think, you know, Woodrow Wilson and other officials from the 20s identified very early on the power that the movies had to change hearts and minds. But it wasn't until World War II that the movies really served a propagandistic purpose. After the U.S. entered the war, obviously a ton of movies go into production, like Sergeant York and Mrs. Miniver, movies that were designed to do two things. One, to sort of signal American values abroad, but also rally American support at home. And then after World War II, films actually become a critical part of the Marshall Plan. And movies are made and sent to Europe to try and essentially pitch Europeans on the virtues of capitalism and democracy and liberal values. And this is the sort of expectation that I think a lot of Americans have for Hollywood going up through the Cold War. And it isn't until the 1990s, early 2000s, that we start to see a global market take shape that is going to make, that's really going to put some strain on Hollywood's ability to be a purely American vessel.
During the 30s and, well, actually 40s and 50s, the U.S. government got very involved with censors and the McCarthy era blacklist. So that, I guess, is a risk that's not only exclusive to authoritarian governments, or is China somehow different than those bad old days were in the States?
I think China is different. I mean, I think it's definitely worth looking and contrasting the two models and looking at how the movies have served governmental purposes in the U.S. versus that in China. I always just caution people drawing these parallels that China has a much more systemized model and an ability to really essentially conscript its entertainers into doing the CCP's bidding. I mean, in China, every movie before it is put into production is approved at a script level and then approved yet again before it is released in theaters. And not only that, but whenever the government decides that it wants to put forward a certain message, whether it's, you know, we want to help celebrate an anniversary of the CCP or of the People's Liberation Army, it will go so far as to say, and we're going to have 12 movies produced about it. And then suddenly directors and actors and producers get a phone call that say, you know, we'd like you to show up on set next Wednesday and make this movie for us. So it's much more hands-on, much more deliberate than I think the more kind of, I would say, like less deliberate, less tethered model that had emerged over the years in America.
Well, looking at it from a global perspective, China has other global outreach policies, for example, the Belt and Road Initiative. Do they coordinate their film policy with these other policies? Is it very clear when they don't say, here's a script, we want you to show up and make this movie? Are their policy directives very clear to film directors and producers around the world? Or do you have to guess at what they would be happy with?
You know, it's like anything, I think, with China's ruling party. It's a mix of both. I mean, on one hand, you've never seen a bureaucracy put out more papers, speeches, official documentation of what it wants to do, what it's planning to do. I mean, this is a party that rules in 5-year plans. However, I think that one thing that is very also very important about understanding this dynamic is just how oftentimes it relies on looking at the where the wind is blowing. And a perfect example of this is the Belt and Road Initiative, because the Belt and Road Initiative is this collection of very deliberate, trade policies and investments and plans. And yet there's also this cultural complement to it that I think gets less attention. And it's funny because you can trace what China wants to do off screen by what it is often doing on screen. So I'll give you an example. So over the past 5 or 6 years or so, as Belt and Road development has deepened in certain countries, it's not uncommon for there to be a co-production treaty announced between China and whatever country it is deepening those ties with. Similarly, I think, China allows in about 30 to 35 foreign films a year. And the countries of origin for those films often reflect the geopolitical alliances that are forming outside of China. So for instance, when relations with the US were good, a lot of American movies got in. When they deteriorated during the Trump administration, more European and Southeast Asian films got in, and more American films were denied. So you can sort of see how everything kind of moves in concert, if not officially, then unofficially.
Well, since we're talking about international and there's Belt and Road Initiative, tell us the story of how China captured large parts of the African viewing public for its own film and TV shows.
This was my favorite part of the book to report, because as I said, I think we know quite a bit about the Belt and Road Initiative and just sort of how expansive it is. But there is a soft power element that I think is underappreciated here. So whenever I was working on the book, I tried to think about, what is the best way to tell this story? And it was easy to find co-productions between China and Belt and Road countries. But there was an effort in Africa that I thought really, really dwarfed all of them. And it was called the 10,000 Villages Project, which is a project run out of Beijing to distribute low-cost satellite dishes to 10,000 African villages. And these are villages where often there already is quite a Chinese omnipresence. And whether it is in the form of train stations or new highways or hospital equipment or, in the past 2 years, vaccines, these are villages where China has already shown up in force. However, the satellite dishes are doing something different. They're oftentimes introducing these villagers to China itself. So in one village I went to in Kenya, where these satellite dishes had been distributed, it was very common to walk into an apartment and see families watching Chinese soap operas, or Chinese kung fu, or Chinese dramas, and to meet young children who, if not preferred Chinese entertainment to American entertainment, then allowed for a kind of coexistence that I think most Americans have kind of challenged a lot of the American complacency around how we have been the default entertainment for so long. And so the satellite dishes serve a number of different purposes. As I said, one is they sort of introduce Chinese culture, Chinese values to these villagers, but they also kind of give a face to this country, this superpower that has appeared seemingly overnight.
So that is the aspect of competition between America and China in other countries in the film field. But China itself, as the largest market in the world and nearly the largest economy, is very attractive to investors. And American film and media companies look at China. Disney was a leader in investing in China. And you tell a very moving story about how its remake of Mulan became a giant fiasco. Tell us a little about that.
You're absolutely right. And it's the perfect, Disney's the perfect example of a company that rushed into China and rushed toward its billion consumers and then saw suddenly all of that investment turn into something of a vulnerability and or a liability, I should say. And Mulan was a fascinating example. I think we all remember the original animated version of the film that came out in the late 90s. Before China was a major market at all. And about 20 years later, Disney had a strategy of remaking a lot of those animated classics into live-action films. They did it with Beauty and the Beast, they did it with Cinderella, they did it with a few others. And Mulan was something of a no-brainer, because here you have not only an animated classic, but you have a movie that might have direct and obvious appeal in what had become the world's most important foreign market. And so Mulan is made, a live action version of Mulan is made. Disney tries as hard as it can to get it right and to make it in a way that will appeal to Chinese audiences. But then as the movie is about to come out in 2020, it is revealed that the film had shot scenes in Xinjiang province, which is where the Uyghur minorities have been held in re-education camps and persecuted for their beliefs. You know, it seems like almost every week now we have more and more reports coming from that province of some pretty terrifying practices that the CCP is implementing against the Uyghurs. And so Disney, having filmed in that province and at one point even thanking local authorities in the credits of the film, really became this case study in how all of that potential revenue comes at a major cost, and a real can really become a thicket of political liability very quickly. And not only that, but It also really dented the film's prospects in China, because when all of that news and attention swarmed around Xinjiang, obviously authorities in Beijing didn't want this movie to get any more attention than it otherwise would have. So they pulled all of the marketing from it. And then what was fascinating as well is that the actual movie, absent the Xinjiang controversy, really fell flat with Chinese audiences, because it was an American version of a Chinese story that came at a time when they were embracing Chinese versions of Chinese stories. So over the past several years, China's film industry has grown more and more sophisticated, and Chinese audiences have understandably started preferring to see Chinese stories. And this shouldn't come as a surprise, right? But I think it did in many corners of Hollywood. And what was interesting was the Chinese audiences now having their own version of Chinese stories didn't need an American version of it. As I often say, you know, would we expect Americans to go see a Chinese version of Davy Crockett?
Yes, you point that obvious point out in the book, and I'm wondering, do you think that the fact that Disney executives didn't consider that issue is just a reflection of our American, you could say, arrogance and narcissism, or let's just say sometimes excessive self-confidence?
Well, that's kind. I think it is. I think that absolutely China's ability to mount a local competitor to Hollywood caught a lot of Hollywood executives off guard, because what Hollywood had in China and actually in markets around the world was a unique product. One of the reasons why Hollywood became the global entertainment capital was because it really was the only market that was able to make big budget, expensive films that could be distributed around the world. You know, other entertainment capitals of the early 20th century, like Germany or France, they didn't have home markets that could sustain that kind of production. And so whenever Hollywood movies would come into the Chinese market, everybody would go see them because there was no other place to see something with that much spectacle and that much bombast. And so Hollywood really was the only game in town for a while when it came to a certain kind of film. It just, it so happens that China was very eager to learn how to do it themselves and very soon did.
Well, for our listeners who are not investors in the film industry and not film historians, but just people who enjoy movies, give us some examples of the Chinese impact on what we see in American-made movies. You write about harm to the careers of various actors and directors, and, well, tell us.
So I think the dynamic to understand here is that, as you said in your introduction, American movies started flowing into China in 1994, and really, at the time, the country was something of an economic afterthought. It wasn't until about 15 years later that the box office started to grow very quickly. And it became very obvious, even as early as 2010, that China was going to become the number one box office in the world. And so you have a growth market for an industry that had thought that it had saturated the world. And then the other dynamic that you have to keep in mind here is that you cannot access that growth market until a movie has been approved by Communist Party censors. So that means you have to avoid any and all themes or instances of dialogue or even just pure images that the censors might take issue with. So what does that mean? That means you have to avoid what they call the three T's, Tibet, Taiwan, and Tiananmen Square. No movie is going to touch on any of those topics. If there is a map shown in a movie, it has to adhere to the One China policy and present Taiwan as part of China. But also I think the number one sensitivity is anything that presents China in a bad light. So for instance, when the zombie apocalypse movie World War Z was in post-production, executives at Paramount removed a scene that implied that the zombie outbreak had originated in China because they worried that officials would be angry if it was released like that. Actors, as you said, who have spoken out against China have been blacklisted in the country. Most famously, I think, is Richard Gere, who, starting in the early 90s, became a massive proponent of the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan cause. And for a while, this had no impact on his career because no one was really thinking about China. But because he was so vocal in his criticism of the country, as China's box office leverage grew, Gere became radioactive. And starting around 2009, no studio would touch him because they knew that even if he was just in the movie at all, it didn't stand a chance of getting into China. And not only that, working with him might jeopardize their other releases in the market too. And so Gere has been essentially blacklisted. And that's why, if you look at his recent filmography, a lot of it is smaller independent films that are being released by companies with no holdings or no business interest in China. But what's interesting, I think, is also that a lot of times now, Hollywood has been working in the market for so long that it is able to anticipate the censors' concerns. So, for instance, there was a movie that came out several years ago called Pixels that had had some scenes of this like global destruction that was happening. And at one point, there was a scene in which the Great Wall was destroyed as part of this destruction. And before the scene was even filmed, executives at Sony who were reading the script said, "Why don't we just make it the Taj Mahal? It's just not worth the potential headache." So there's been this kind of culture of self-censorship that's been absorbed because the studios now have two decades of experience seeing what gets in and what doesn't get in.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
And of course, why would they take any chances? So I guess the risk for us as viewers is movies will be more bland, less controversial. What do you think the anticipatory censorship does to movies?
Well, I think one thing it's done is you know, I think vis-a-vis China, it hasn't allowed this central artery of cultural expression to explore what is becoming the story of the century, right? Which is the US and China. And what model is going to really be the dominant model of the next 100 years? And so it's not been explored with any complexity. On screen, because every portrayal of China has to be so sanitized. And I think that there also may be an effect of really contributing to American misunderstanding of China or of life in China, because it has either been avoided, as you said, to avoid the headache, or presented in such a flat, safe way that there's no nuance, and without any nuance, it can be hard, I think, to have any kind of empathy or any kind of, frankly, curiosity about life there. And so I think that's one effect. I think there's also, you know, just the global market in general has really flattened a lot of storytelling. You know, the new Top Gun movie, which is the big box office hit of the moment, very deliberately avoids any kind of overt villain in the film. The bad guys in this movie are in some unidentified country. We don't know where they are. There's like, at one point there's snow, at one point there's sand. I mean, I cannot figure out by way of climate or distance where this country is, where the bad guys are. And whenever the American heroes go to this country, all of the enemy pilots are wearing helmets to conceal any nationality. And I think it's because these movies now have to be made such that they cannot alienate any potential audience. And so it actually gets, I think, a little laughable at times. The means by which these films that will go to avoid any kind of specific conflict.
So the fact that you can't criticize or show China in a bad light, that will mean that the movie's villains can't be Chinese, but they don't have to be Western either. They can be sort of mythological.
Right, that, right.
Yeah.
Well, mythological certainly helps. I've also noticed, I think, a rise in just kind of like generic, stateless, Eastern European, Soviet bloc villains who are kind of operating on their own accord. That seems to be the other sort of preferred tactic.
Well, Tell us a little about how COVID-19 impacted this phenomenon.
Well, so it was fascinating because, you know, before COVID in 2019 or so, we knew that China was going to become the number one box office in the world, but we weren't sure when it was going to happen. And then when COVID-19 hit, and it closed all of the U.S. movie theaters, and for a while closed all the theaters in China, it allowed China to really spring forward in a real way. So Chinese movie theaters reopened faster than American theaters did, and allowed China to become the number one box office in the world. Now, of course, there was a huge asterisk on that because it wasn't a fair playing field because American theaters were closed at the time. But nonetheless, it was a real symbolic moment that here we were just 26 years after the Chinese entertainment industry had really opened at all, and it had supplanted the U.S. The other thing that happened was COVID-19 really deteriorated relations between China and the U.S., and it really contributed to this feeling in China that it was going to try to rely less and less on American movies in its market. So it was really since then that we've seen American movies struggle to be approved for release. And so it's been this weird dance where, you know, right after COVID-19, there was this very weird moment where because China's economy had recovered so much faster than America's, all kinds of Western businesses were suddenly more reliant on China than ever before. And you had this moment in late 2020, early 21, which is when I was finishing the book, where fashion, tech, cars, every conceivable Western business were reporting these earnings where essentially the executives were saying, thank God for China, because it's really keeping our lights on right now because the U.S. economy is still struggling to get out from under COVID-19. Since then, obviously now things are sort of reversed again because China is shutting down so many major cities. But I think it really did contribute to a pretty severe deterioration in relations between the U.S. and Hollywood. And I don't know going forward what kind of certainty Hollywood's going to have when it comes to accessing this market.
The relationship between culture, politics, and money is not a new one, and it's not exclusive to the China-U.S. Competition. But there's something special about this that's not the same as just art and money always being intertwined. What is it that you think is different about this than other competition in the system?
I think the main difference is that it's happening between two countries that are larger ideological rivals. And it's really, I think, turned the movies into something of a proxy battleground. And this really hit home for me when I was in Kenya, and I had spent several days, as I said, in these villages with these satellite dishes. And then I met with an official. This ends the book, but I met with an official who was the country's film minister, who was basically in charge of deciding what kinds of movies and TV shows his people watched. And he was an incredibly conservative, very socially conservative man. And he said to me, I love importing Chinese movies because they've already been censored for me. And I don't need to worry about Western values coming and corrupting my people. And I thought, well, this really brings it home because this is about more than just the money that you make on what kinds of movies you put out. This is about using the movies to reflect what kind of geopolitical alliance you want to form. And obviously, there's a big difference between an alliance with the U.S. and an alliance with China when it comes to the model of governance and the values that are going to be exported So I think that is the key difference here. And that is why I actually thought that there was a book here to do, which was because this is a larger story than just where box office ticket sales come from.
So a country like China has no problem ideologically inserting its political and ideological and values goals in it. But you're a Wall Street Journal reporter, so Hollywood seems to be operating according to basic capitalistic principles. It's going after a big market. It's adapting its products to please their customers. What's wrong with that? Why won't that succeed?
Well, I think you're channeling in that question really what I hear a lot of times from executives, which is, you know, we have a fiduciary responsibility to exploit any market we can. I think also they might even say, look, is it the worst thing in the world that, you know, Chinese moviegoers are getting to see fun, entertaining films? You know, it's not every business decision has to be inherently political, I think they would say. And I think I completely understand. And I think, look, we're in a world now where if China shut off its access to all Hollywood films tomorrow, the studios would be in a world of hurt, and their shareholders would be, and their employees would be, cuts would have to come from somewhere. Right. But I think that the tension here is that these are capitalist motivations working in a country with capitalist and political aims. And this is where I think the legacy question comes up. I think that a lot of the executives in Hollywood who were, you know, eagerly censoring films to make sure that they played in China and made money in Chinese movie theaters, were really thinking on a quarter by quarter basis and thinking about how they could make their numbers for the corporate parent company, right? How they could make that happen. And I think that in China, there was a much longer term incentive there. And so I wonder, and I don't know the answer to this, but I wonder how some of these decisions will be reviewed 50 years from now. When we look back on China's rise and China's challenge to the U.S. and its challenge to liberal democracy, how these decisions to kind of rush toward its consumers and do whatever its leaders asked of it will be viewed in retrospect.
That shorter term thinking is a problem for the U.S. and the West in general on many levels compared to China. Yes, they do have a very long-term view and more patience because they have different outcome variables. So there's a lot at stake. What do you think, finally and ultimately, this is the hardest question for you, so I left it for last. What, as someone who likes movies as an art form and as an entertainment form, as well as looking at it as an industry and a business, what do you think the film industry should do to compete more effectively on every level?
Well, I think what it's trying to do now is bifurcate the business. And that's why we have the rise of streaming and which is really, I would say, a model that is less reliant on markets like China. And more about subscriber growth, right? So it's not going to rely as much on accessing that Chinese box office. So I think the rise of streaming is something of a hedge against China's influence. But I think this is a tricky question, you know, and this has come up when I talk to people in DC as well, because I think there's now a broader bipartisan coalition of politicians who want to do something about this Hollywood censorship and the concessions that Western business is making to maintain access to the Chinese market. And I'm struggling to think though about what that could look like though. I don't think anyone wants a world where American politicians are ordering up movies the way that Chinese officials can do so with Chinese filmmakers. I don't think that's necessarily an option. And I don't think anybody wants a world where politicians are punishing studios for the way they do business. But I'm curious. I think the final leg, though, that we haven't quite seen is sustained consumer backlash. There's been a number of high profile examples of this kind of censorship causing consternation among some consumers, but it seems to fade rather quickly. And so, one thing I'm very curious to see is how Hollywood responds if that backlash grows louder and is able to sort of last longer than a few days. What then might they have to do? But it's a really thorny situation that Hollywood finds itself in, because to allude to the start of our conversation, it's really the first time in Hollywood history that executives find themselves at odds with their home government.
And nobody really seems to know the answer yet. So, yeah, well, I'm glad to know that people are working on it. Yeah, we have to figure out a smart response to this challenge. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today, Eric. Lots of good luck with the book.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
The book is Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy, an important book. Thank you, and thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff.